the latest on rabies in Maine. Already this spring, at least 26 Maine communities have reported a confirmed case of rabies. The great majority of these cases so far have been found in raccoons, but officials have also identified rabid bats, skunks, and foxes. Rabies is found in both rural and urban areas. I'm Jennifer Rooks. It's not always easy to identify a rabid animal or to know what to do if you encounter one. On today's program, we will discuss how to best protect your family from rabid animals and how to respond if you or one of your pets is attacked. What are your questions about rabies in Maine? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio Studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It's alarming when we hear news stories of rabid wild animals entering people's homes, but that's pretty rare. It still, however, raises the question of how to watch out for rabid animals and what to do to protect your family and your pets. Our experts today will share some advice. Joining me in the studio, Rachel Fisk. She is Assistant State Veterinarian with the Division of Animal Health and Animal Welfare in the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. And Scott Lindsay is Regional Wildlife Biologist for the Sebago Lake Region with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you want to know how to spot a wild animal that might have rabies? Do you want to know what to do? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to both of you, and thank you so much. It seems to me we're hearing about a lot of cases recently in the news. Rachel, I'll start with you. Is there an unusually large number of cases of rabies this year compared to years past, or is this pretty typical?
So this is actually pretty typical for this year. So far in 2019, we've had 31 positive animals that have tested positive for rabies in the state's health and environmental testing lab, which is our rabies lab here in Augusta. And that's a little bit higher than average, but still really, truly average for Maine for this time of year.
Okay. And what is rabies exactly? I think a lot of people have heard about it, you know, or worried about it. What is it?
So it's a viral disease. It is a zoonotic disease, which means it can be transmitted between animals and humans. And it affects all mammalian species. So anything with hair can be susceptible to rabies. It's a neurologic disease. So the virus travels up nerve pathways after an exposure, travels into the spinal cord, into the brain, and then animals start behaving abnormally. And it's unfortunately universally fatal, if not intercepted early before signs have begun.
All right. Well, Scott, tell us, I read that most of the cases so far are raccoons. What do you see? What kinds of animals are likely to have rabies? And then how likely? If I see a raccoon, is it likely to have rabies?
Okay. Well, as Rachel said, all mammals can potentially carry rabies. But the big four in Maine are going to be a raccoon, skunk, the fox, which we have a red fox and a gray fox, and the bat. So those are going to be the ones that are the primary wildlife species that you would potentially see rabies in that we may see fairly regular basis. And by no means is an animal going to be positive for rabies just because you see it. Animals, particularly ones that are born, of course, in the spring and through the summer, we live in a state where we're blessed to have a lot of wildlife around us. And it can be a totally normal experience to see animals in your backyard. Most of the time, wild animals are going to try to avoid close contact with people, though. So if you see an animal that is behaving outside of the normal and it is coming very close to you, does not seem to be responsive to you, perhaps an animal that has porcupine quills in it, which would indicate that animal maybe did not give a porcupine enough space and could be an indication it could be sick, although not always. Something that is just an animal that is just kind of lying down maybe in your driveway or in your backyard and appears like it is very lethargic, that's unusual. At the same time, an animal that's very aggressive that you encounter and doesn't just try to flee, but actively tries to attack you. Those are all things that are kind of red flags, I would say. That may not be normal, but if you see a family of fox or a single one in your backyard, even during the day, it is not necessarily an indication that's a rabid animal.
Right. So how long, let's say a fox contracts rabies, how long between the time it contracts it will it die?
Yeah, that would be the incubation period is the period that measured by the time it is exposed to rabies and the time that it begins to be symptomatic for rabies. In other words, will show physically or behaviorally that it is positive for rabies. And that is highly variable between different wildlife species. Mm. But I defer to Rachel on that. I mean, it normally the time it gets to the central nervous system is when it's going to start being symptomatic. And that can be about how many weeks to months?
So it actually depends a little bit on a lot of factors, including the strain of the virus. It depends on the dose of the virus. So was it a scratch or was it a good bite that exposed this animal to the virus? And then it can even depend on where on the body the animal was exposed. So again, the rabies virus travels up nerve pathways. So exposure on the hind limb, for instance, may result in a longer incubation period for the virus to actually reach the brain than a bite on, say, the cheek, for instance.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm curious, back to the question I was posing a little bit ago. We've talked about the big four, which are raccoons, skunks, foxes, and bats. What percentage, do we know what percentage of those animals have it? I mean, how many? I know that bats, because of white nose syndrome, are on the decline. So we don't want to be killing healthy bats if they're in our attic or something like that. Do we have a sense of is it 1% of bats? Is it 10%? Is it more than that?
Well, a lot of, as far as a percentage, it's important to note that when we're getting testing at our health environmental testing lab, they are testing animals that are have been in contact with either people or domestic
right,
animals.
So they don't represent the general population.
Correct. We're not testing the whole population, looking at a percentage of that. Generally, it's a very small percentage of animals. For instance, bats, we're looking at, potentially it's been estimated that, 1 to 2% of the bat population may carry rabies. So that is correct. I mean, we do not want to just assume that everything is rabid. But at the same time, I would caution people to behave in a way that you would want to minimize your exposure to all wild animals. There's a potential it could be positive. And at the same time, as was said with the incubation periods, there are times when that animal may carry rabies, but it may not show any outward signs that it is infected with it. So there's the potential that you could get exposed at that point with an animal that, is not really showing obvious signs of rabies at that point. So every wild animal, really, you should try to avoid physical contact with. But as far as percentages, we're looking at fairly small percentages with bats of all the animals that we test. There's, again, but less than 5% for bats. You're looking at, of the raccoons that come in, raccoons and skunks tend to be more, perhaps over 50-60% of the ones that are brought in are going to be positive. But it's important to stress that is not a percentage of the healthy population.
Right, the general population.
That is the ones that have met that criteria that this animal has a red flag, it's been in contact potentially with someone showing unusual behavior. So thus, it's going to be eligible for testing. So that should be considered as well.
My understanding is sometimes when people have been bitten by a bat, they don't always know it.
That's correct. And that is why we want to be especially vigilant about any potential exposure you have to bats. Now, what I would advise is if you find a bat in your house and you don't know how long it's been there, and someone has been in that room, then at that point, your best course of action is to try to capture that bat and submit that bat for testing to the Health Environmental Testing Lab. Bat teeth are very, very small. You would not probably notice it if you got bitten. Certainly a sleeping child or an adult would be much less likely to even notice it. So you could wake up and not have any recollection of having contact with a bat at all. And that could be bad because, again, rabies could progress from that point. So if you see a bat, it probably should be tested. If, on the other hand, you say, come home, it's in the daytime, you come home, no one's been in that room, and you see a bat that is flying around and there's indications it likely got in earlier, maybe there's a window open or something like that. At that point, you could close the door to that room, turn on the lights, open up the windows, get in a secure place, and watch that bat leave throughout the window and close the window. But again, with bats, bats seem to be the one animal out of those big four that is probably more likely to transmit rabies to people in the rare occasions where it's happened. So I think we do want to be very vigilant about that when they're in our homes.
So when they're in the home, especially if they're in a bedroom and you don't know how long, in a bedroom that's been occupied and you don't know how long they've been there, if somebody comes and says, you know, I think you have bats in your attic, I'm guessing that's a different story.
If they're outside your living quarters, then yes, that is a different story. Again, you still likely, I would not advise people to keep the bats in that attic. There's ways that we can assist with contractors that can come and remove them at the appropriate time of year. But the ones in the living quarters are the ones that we want to be most concerned about. And fortunately, the epidemiologists from CDC are very accessible. And usually when I've spoken to them in those situations where there's a bat in the house with a person that's been in the room, they're often going to take the conservative approach and say, let's go ahead and capture that bat and have it tested.
I was interested to read, you know, studying up for this program today, that there is a rabies vaccination, but only folks like you all usually get it, only people who work with animals regularly. Why is that? Why is rabies vaccination not something everybody gets?
I think that probably the biggest reason is potentially cost. So it's a 3-series vaccine, and there are varying effects in people. So some people develop a great immunity. Some people don't develop much of an immunity at all and need to be revaccinated. But it is also one of those vaccines that is often not covered by health insurance. So it can be up to $1,000 out of pocket cost to get vaccinated and be afforded some protection. I also think that the general public probably has a very, very low risk of encountering a rabid animal. So generally, it's a vaccine that's recommended for people that work with wildlife or work with domesticated species that could be rabid. So veterinarians, vet techs, wildlife, game wardens, biologists, animal control officers.
How common, we've talked about pets. We hear about raccoons or foxes biting dogs. And humans, how common is it for farm animals, cows, horses, sheep, to be attacked and have to, how much of a risk is it for farmers?
There's definitely a risk. We hear about and speak to farmers that will call the Department of Agriculture, Conservation and Forestry on a regular basis, or their veterinarians will contact us if they have some questions. It's not uncommon to hear of a funny acting raccoon being found in a barn with some dairy cows. So we would ask more specific questions to determine, you know, what was the risk to the cows specifically, or sometimes some funny acting wildlife are found in a field with some horses. So again, it depends on the animal's vaccine status. Have they been vaccinated? Are they up to date on their rabies vaccine? And what truly was the risk? Sometimes an astute animal owner or veterinarian can actually find a wound And then certainly we would be much more concerned than if we found, you know, for instance, a funny acting skunk in the, you know, in a pile of hay that, you know, no livestock was actually close to in recent time.
You know, you mentioned the big four, Scott. I'm wondering about other animals. So things like mice, squirrels, chipmunks, they're not likely to have rabies?
Small mammals, rabbits, small rodents, they certainly can get it, and it has been found in a laboratory situation where they are separated from other animals that they can manifest that virus. The reason why we did not see this in the wild is frequently those small mammals, they have an encounter with a positive, larger animal that is positive for rabies. Most of the time, they would not survive such an encounter. So they are going to die during what would be an incubation period, and they would not have the disease make it to the central nervous system.
So they're going to get eaten before they develop the rabies. Yeah.
Correct.
What about larger animals? What about deer and moose and bears?
I have not seen anything as far as a documentation of rabies in cervids. Again, I'd have to say the disclaimer, it potentially could occur in any of those. But there certainly is a variance in the susceptibility of animals. For instance, we see the opossum, a fairly recent arrival in Maine. They seem to have some lower susceptibility to rabies than other animals. We have, on occasion, we get a woodchuck that is positive as well. So there's some variation there, and it does seem as though, again, those big four just happen to be the ones that are going to be in contact with other animals, so there's a higher likelihood of transmission of the virus, and also they just seem to be just more susceptible for some reason.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation about rabies, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do New England Cancer Specialists, committed to excellence and now a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative, newenglandcancerspecialists.org. Taggart Construction in Freeport, working to create healthy homes that respect the environment since 1994, tagcon.com. And McVetti's Hearth and Home, offering patio furniture, grills, and wood swing sets for family-friendly spaces. More at stovesofmaine.com.
On the next Fresh Air, breaking the story of R&B star R. Kelly's underage sexual victims, we talk with Jim DeRogatis. The stories he broke include the sex tape, or rape tape, that led to Kelly's 2008 trial, and the sex cult that Kelly ran. DeRogatis has spoken to many of Kelly's victims. He has a new book called Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. Join us.
Fresh Air is this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. June is Music That Moves Me Month here on Maine Public Radio. With the support of the Maine Community Foundation and Verrill Dana, a key component of this effort is our previously loved used instrument collection drive. We're collecting used instruments for deserving young musicians across our state. If you have an instrument or two collecting dust somewhere in the recesses of your attic, closet, or cellar, please consider donating it. And it's easy. Stop by our Portland, Bangor, or Lewiston offices and drop them off. For more information, visit mainepublic.org and click on the banner or on events. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are learning about rabies. Joining me, Scott Lindsay, who is regional wildlife biology for the Sebago Lake region with Maine IFNW, and Rachel Fisk, assistant state veterinarian with the Division of Animal Health and Animal Welfare Program. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with John in Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. A long time ago, when I was in the Army, we were in northern Thailand. We were engineers, and we were building roads. And one of my sergeants got bit by something, and he was tested positive for rabies. And he had to get he had to get these shots in his stomach, and there was this whole series of them. and the shots were so debilitating that he couldn't, he had to be medevaced out of Thailand because of the shots. And I answered that there's a vaccine for it, but what happens after exposure? He was positive for rabies, and to those were the shots he got. Is there anything for treatment of rabies after exposure?
Sure, and John, it's a good question. I know that a lot of people have that. I too remember somebody in my neighborhood having to get those shots, and that poor little boy, it was horrible. Is it the same now, Rachel?
So it's not. So I am a veterinarian and not a human medical professional, but I am aware of the post-exposure prophylaxis protocol that that people who have been determined to be exposed undergo. So it's no longer shots in the stomach. You would get a two-part treatment. So the first part is an infusion of rabies immune globulin, and that's typically done at the site of the exposure, so a bite or a scratch. And then it is a series of shots, but they're like vaccines, so similar to a flu shot in your arm. So they just go in the muscle. So I believe it's five shots after the fact. So.
And not as debilitating as what it used to be.
No, definitely not.
John, thank you so much for your question. I know a lot of people share that question. We have an email from Elizabeth. Bat houses are often recommended for insect control in yards, but I've always been leery of welcoming bats into my yard because of the risk of rabies. Is my fear realistic, or should I let my fear go?
I would say that it is. Bats have far more positive attributes to us than the concerns as far as rabies. And it is true, I don't take it lightly. We do know that, again, they can carry rabies, and we do not want to be exposed to bats. But when bats are doing their thing and they are feeding on large numbers of insects, they play a very important role in the ecosystem. They also play a very important role economically in many parts of the world as far as the reducing damage to agricultural products by feeding on insects that are damaging to those crops. So very many positive attributes. I would say that I would not want them in my house for good reasons, which we've discussed. I would also say that since we do not want them in the house, it is totally fine to put up a bat house. Bat Conservation International is a good source of information on how to do those. I've frequently seen them in stores in certain places, and they may look nice, and it may kind of be more like a yard ornament because it may not attract many bats, so you want to make sure that it's designed appropriately or bats won't go in it. So Bat Conservation International would be a good source that you could look at for that, and I think it would be very good to have them in your property. Yes.
And I've heard that bats actually like to live under shingle-style houses, under the shingles in shingle-style houses.
Yes, very much so.
Better than a bat house.
They would, and sometimes with bat houses, that's correct. With bat houses, be patient. You don't expect to have them occupied the first year. It may take 3 years or more for them to find that. So patience with them, but they can work when they're done correctly and they're large enough.
Patience is a virtue. We'll go to Tom calling from Falmouth. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to add a little bit of clarity to the post-exposure treatment regimen. The initial day one, once treatment is decided that it's required, and my own non-scientific study working in hospitals and ERs, the most common exposure is to bats. And that's a non-scientific result, but that's just my opinion. The first day, you get an immune globulin. And the difficulty with that, it's weight-based dosing. So sometimes the volume of that injection exceeds 10 mLs, and you can't give 10 mLs in one injection. You have to break that into three. So then you get a single dose of the vaccine as well. And then on day 7, you get another vaccine dose, then day 14, and they used to go to day 21, and that's where the 5-dose series comes in, but now it's just a 4-dose. But the other issue with that immune globulin vaccine combination, the cost factor is north of $10,000, not $1,000.
Wow.
It's very expensive. And if you don't have insurance, it's really difficult.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for calling and adding your voice to the conversation. Important information. The Veterinary and Rehabilitation Center of Cape Elizabeth has sent us an email. We are so concerned about rabies this year that we are planning to hold a rabies clinic later this summer to make the vaccine more affordable and accessible. I am afraid we have become too complacent about this disease, but it is in our area, and it is 100% fatal to people and pets if not caught immediately, and so preventable with vaccination. This is a public health issue that needs to be proactively addressed. Scott.
Yes, and I could add to that, Jennifer, and as well as what the caller just said as well. I think it is important to point out that put yourself in a situation where you just walk out in your backyard, and all of a sudden you're exposed to an animal that jumps out of a hedge or something, and you get bitten. I certainly can understand how someone's going to feel when that happens. And first thing you really want to think about, though, is it's very important to try to capture that animal and have it submitted for rabies testing. That animal has to be dead to be tested. So rather than given an opportunity to get away from the site, all measures should be taken, not putting yourself at additional risk, to try to have that animal killed and safely contained so that it can be tested. Reason being, if the animal cannot be found, it makes it more complicated as far as afterwards deciding on post-exposure prophylaxis. If that animal is found, that will generally be tested in very quick, within 1 day, 2 days. And at that point, we know whether that animal is positive or not. It makes it a lot easier to make decisions on what needs to be done as far as you, between you and your primary care physician. So I know it sounds difficult to do, but in many of the occasions we've had people exposed in our area, you read about how they're able to contain that animal and do it in a way that you can use anything handy around that you have for it, and you know, hit the animal, blunt force, whatever you can do. You should make an effort not to damage head brain tissue if possible, and that would be something that would be very important. Another thing that's very important is, of course, the first thing that we'd want to do as well is to clean any place where you have had exposure to that animal as well, and follow it up immediately with a call to your primary care physician, and call our department as well if this is a wild animal. And again, I can provide the numbers for you if you wanted to put it on your website or
Facebook
page.
Sure, we definitely will do that. But let me ask you about that, because there was a story that made some news headlines last year, and I believe it was just last year, where the 90-year-old man in Brunswick was fixing his deck, and was it a rabid raccoon that approached him, and he hit it with a board and was able to kill it. But you don't want brain tissue damaged. I mean, do you not hit it on the head?
You, again, I know it's hard to be picky when you're trying to
fight a rabid
animal.
Yeah.
So we understand you got to do what you can. Hitting it with a stick or something, that is not going to damage the brain tissue. What we try to avoid doing is using a firearm to shoot
gotcha.
An animal in the head. And it'd be more difficult to secure enough brain tissue that it could be tested. But still, if that's the only way to do it, then I think if you're in a safe place to do that, and if you can avoid additional exposure from the animal and anything that may result from that, then I think that would be advisable, as opposed to if your other option is to have it run away, then
right.
I would
try
to.
So that's what I was going to say. I want to make it really clear here. So first, and ideally, you see an animal that's acting unusually, you call your local animal control or law enforcement if there's not animal control in your town. Secondly, but if that animal does seem to be attacking you or a pet, don't chase it away, but instead try to kill that animal, try to hit it with something.
Yep, or have someone there that's with you that can see it, that can do so, and you can immediately start cleaning any place where you've had exposure to that wound and calling your PCP.
Yeah, that's right. Always wash the wound, and you're nodding as well.
Absolutely.
Rachel, we're going to go to Tom calling from Portland. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a couple of questions regarding the transmission of rabies. I have no problem imagining a raccoon attacking a raccoon or a skunk attacking a person. How do bats get rabies? I don't imagine that we're getting too many rabid raccoons grabbing bats out of the air. What's the transmission mode between bats? And the second question is, how long does the virus remain viable in a dead animal? If an animal dies of rabies in the woods, and that corpse lies around for a week, is that still a dangerous piece of carrion, or does the virus expire quickly?
Thanks, Tom. Good questions.
Okay, Tom. As far as part two of your question regarding the viability of rabies in an animal which has died, generally it is believed that rabies is going to be non-viable 24 hours post-mortem. The exception to that would be if you are in a, and again, that is a, in what's considered a warm, putrefied environment. Okay? If it is, I know a terrible word, but you get the point. If the animal is rotting,
February.
If the animal is rotting by the side of the road and then decomposition has started, right, and some people will ask, you know, is scavengers going to potentially be exposed to that? Much less likely under those conditions. Now, let's say you're in the shoulder seasons in spring and fall, and it's still a time when we could potentially see rabies. You don't usually see it in the middle of winter, although it's potential, but usually, I mean, spring, fall, and summer. Spring and fall, if that animal is in a cool environment post-mortem, that virus could persist for many days afterwards. So thus, it is always still a good precaution that despite how long that animal's been there, if it's dead, it's safe to just assume that potentially it could be rabid and you're going to treat it the same way.
So if there's a dead raccoon and a fox bites it or feeds on it, the fox could get rabies.
If it is soon after the animal dies, yes. Or if that animal dies in the, 40 degrees or less in a cooler time of year, then if that animal is scavenged by another animal, then potentially that still could be viable at that point.
Sure, yes. And then what about his bat transmission question, Tom's question about that?
Well, any time that it doesn't matter, I suppose, which one is going to be the aggressor in the encounter, but any time there's the exposure of either neural tissue or saliva between those two different animals, then that virus can be transmitted. So if that bat is in contact with another animal that is going to be positive, it's correct that I don't think there's going to be many situations where a fox or a raccoon may try to feed on a bat, but it's certainly something that certainly could happen, and then once it is prevalent in a local population of bats in a colony, they are social animals, so it's much more easily transmitted to other animals. So again, there's multiple times these animals can come into contact, and all it takes is one situation where it could be a positive rabies infecting an animal which is non-rabies, and it's going to continue that cycle on.
Tom, thanks for your questions. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments about rabies. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine State Music Theater, presenting Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Ladies, June 5th through the 22nd. Tickets at msmt.org. The Freeman Ellis Family Fund, supporting Maine Public Radio, local, national, and international news you can trust. And Northeast Imports, in South Portland, specializing in the sale and service of pre-owned Subarus. NortheastImportsLLC.com.
30 years ago, tanks rolled in and Chinese soldiers fired on demonstrators in Beijing's Tiananmen Square.
A row of tanks stretches from one end of the square to the other. It's clear that square will have a symbolic meaning to this army for some time to come.
NPR's Deb Amos remembers covering the aftermath of Tiananmen Square this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up at 2, World Affairs, Rebuilding the Social Contract, Part 1, We the People. While globalization has lifted millions out of poverty, the geopolitical forces that drove it have largely left the middle class behind. In the first part of the three-part series, a discussion on why the people matter in rebuilding social trust with World Affairs co-host Ray Suarez. That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Understanding Rabies. Joining me, Rachel Fisk, Assistant State Veterinarian, and Scott Lindsay, Wildlife Biologist. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Maggie, who's calling from York. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Rachel, question for you. We were talking earlier, I feel like I'm part of it.
That's just fine, Maggie.
The expense of the rabies vaccine. Now, I have my dog vaccinated every year, mostly because she travels and she needs it to get back into the country. It doesn't cost me that much money. So that's one point. It doesn't cost $10,000. The question I want to ask is she, since she has one every year, susceptible to getting rabies if she were bitten or came in contact with the rabid animal?
So your question is, with the vaccination, how protected is your dog?
Does it protect her 100%? And how come it's so inexpensive to get animals vaccinated and not for people?
Those are great questions, Maggie. And I can answer your second question first. No vaccine is 100% effective in including the rabies vaccine, but we do consider the rabies vaccine for dogs, cats, and other livestock to be a very, very good vaccine. So especially since your dog is vaccinated so regularly, I would consider her, very confident that she would have no problem surviving an exposure. We also do have protocols that are put in place if a domesticated animal, so a dog, cat, or livestock, is attacked by wildlife that is determined to be rabid, she would get an additional booster and be, under sort of increased supervision on your end for a certain period of time. An unvaccinated animal would, domestic animal would undergo a quarantine, for instance. So the rabies vaccine in pets is an excellent vaccine. It's actually the only vaccine in Maine that is required by state law for dogs and cats. I can speak to your second question a little bit, but I don't really know. So you're right that the rabies vaccine for veterinary patients is very cost effective. It's probably one of the least expensive things that veterinarians do. To some extent, we try to keep the price low because of the public health component to dog and cat and other animal vaccination. I think there's probably some degree of the human healthcare system at play as far as human rabies pre-exposure vaccine series. But I'm not really sure. I can really only speak to the veterinary vaccines.
All right, Maggie, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Jeff calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is about the reliability of the test on the suspected carrier, the dead raccoon, so to speak. Hypothetically, the raccoon bites you or scratches you, you manage to kill it, the test comes back negative. What's the reliability on that? Is it a whole lot better than it is for, say, Lyme, where, okay, the test comes back negative, and you say to the doctor, well, what would you do? And he says, well, if it were me, I'd take the antibiotics anyway.
Sure, good question, Jeff. Go ahead, Scott.
As I understand it, the test that Health Environmental Testing Lab uses for determining whether an animal has rabies or not is considered very accurate and is repeatable in laboratory situations. It has a long track record and is considered a very good indicator a reliable indicator of whether that animal is carrying rabies or not, yes.
So you're very comfortable if someone you know is bit by a fox, the fox tests negative for rabies, that they would not have to get medical care after that?
I am. I do have a lot of confidence in Maine CDC and the testing that is done on this. And I think we're fortunate in Maine to have many partners working together to make sure that an animal gets tested if it needs to be and that people get treated if they need to be as well. So, yes, I do have confidence in that. Very important part of that whole process is that test.
All right, Jeff, thanks for your question. Terry on Facebook asks, I'm wondering if rabies can be transmitted in other ways other than animal bites. Can contact with water a rabid animal has drank from or bathed in be a vector?
I am aware of two other rare means of transmission of rabies. One would be aerosolized rabies, and that could incur when the rabies is actually present in the air, and that is something that may occur in a bat hibernacula, which would be an underground cave system. Another potential means of transmission, and again, this is extremely rare and would not be a means not to have a treatment done, but on corneal transplants in people, I believe there's been a small number of cases where it has been transmitted that way. But otherwise, again, we're looking at not so much through water. You have to have direct contact with neural tissue or saliva through an open wound or a mucous membrane on your body to be considered a high likelihood of transmission for that.
So it has to be a scratch or a puncture wound or something like that.
Touching an animal is not going to do it. I believe even contact with blood is not going to do it. It is the mucus, the saliva, and neural tissue.
We'll go to Mike, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hey, I got a question. Last year and this year, I've had a couple encounters with porcupines that were acting very different than, I do wildlife and pest control, acting very different than I've normally experienced. I heard you mention quills. I didn't know if porcupines were rabies carriers at all.
Yes, they have carried rabies in Maine, and Mike, let me see if I can find. I do have the list here, and I believe this year there was only one animal submitted, and that was a negative. But I do know in past years we occasionally have had porcupines. It's a small number of them have been positive. I would say the other thing to consider with porcupines is if you do see other wild animals or domestic animals with porcupine quills in them, that is one thing that may raise a red flag in that that animal that has the porcupine quills in it was not exercising good normal judgment around that porcupine. That's why it got the quills. Other times, it's just a perfectly normal golden retriever that just happens to get too close to them and gets plucked with quills. And we've all been through that, so it's not in and of itself a concern. But if you were to see an animal acting unusually, add to that another piece of evidence of having quills in it, that's something that just raises the level of concern a little more. Most wild animals are going to know to stay away from porcupines.
Most wild animals, not necessarily all dogs,
right,
though.
Right.
Mike, thank you for your call. A question from Steve. Curious if there is any insect transmission of rabies.
No, I believe mammals only.
Yep. No, okay. No rabid insects, no rabid chickens either. Just mammals only.
All right. Well, we'll go to Al calling from Pembroke. Hi, Al. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? A couple of years ago, I was bitten by a cat that someone had captured. It was either a feral cat or an escaped cat or something. And it was pretty vicious, actually. I didn't know it would be. I called my veterinarian to ask what I should do, and he said, well, they'll put the cat, which was in a cage, in quarantine for 3 weeks,
if the cat survived, then I didn't have to do anything. And the explanation was that if an animal is rabid, it will generally be aggressive and bite only in the remaining few days of its life when the virus gets to its brain. And so it will die relatively quickly, and then they would, you know, check the cat for rabies. And then if it was rabid, then I would have to undergo treatments. But until then, I didn't have to do anything. I just had to sit tight and wait. And everything turned out fine. I'm still here. I'm just wondering, was that advice good, correct? It seemed inadequate to me. It seemed odd.
Okay, Rachel.
So that's pretty close. So right now, for a domesticated animal, so cats included, even the ferals, we impose a 10-day bite quarantine, at least if the feral cats or stray cats can be safely contained for 10 days. There's a 10-day bite quarantine, and the reason is exactly what you had mentioned, is that the animals will become aggressive just in the later stages of the disease, will transmit the rabies virus only in the later stages of disease. And if we go back to the statement that it's a universally fatal disease, they'll die within that 10-day waiting period. And if that happens, then the animal does get tested. If they are still alive after 10 days, you know, I always say, well, that dog or that cat may be a jerk, but it didn't have rabies when it bit you. So you would not need to undergo treatment.
So a person can wait. You have a window of opportunity, because I'm thinking, boy, if I've been bit by an animal that I may or may not have rabies, I want to get treated right away. But you can wait?
So it depends. And here's where we rely quite heavily on the Maine CDC epidemiologists. We usually consult with them if we have any question. It depends, again, based on the transmission and the incubation periods, where the bite occurred, how severe it was. But oftentimes rabies is considered an urgency, but not an emergency. Oftentimes that incubation period is at least a week, sometimes usually more, weeks to months.
All right, go ahead.
And I would just add that, and that applies to domestic animals. The distinction with wild animals is that there's variability in that incubation period, so we cannot have those set time limits that we do fortunate to have with domestic animals. So any wild animal that's in a contact with a person would be euthanized. There's no waiting period. Of course,
all right,
we don't hold them.
Thanks for your call, Al. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, Scott, a lot of people think of a mangy-looking animal as an animal that's likely rabid. Is that the case if you see a woodchuck or a fox that sort of just doesn't look good? Is it likely to be rabid?
No, I would not say. It's a totally different condition. Sarcoptic mange, it would be independent of rabies. So they may look like it's a sick animal, but mange is prevalent in many species of our wildlife, and sometimes it is not a permanent condition, and they can actually recover from it. And the other thing to consider is that animals may actually bite themselves, or what's called self-mutilation to themselves, in the latter stages of rabies as well. So thus, there would be a distinction between, it wouldn't actually be a pattern of hair loss on an animal, but if you see an animal that is injured, and sometimes they'll actually chew on their limbs, that could be something that would be the red flag.
So the more important thing is the behavior. Getting back to what you said, unusual behavior. I thank you both for being here. Such an interesting topic. That's Scott Lindsay, Regional Wildlife Biology for the Sebago Lake Region with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Also here, Rachel Fisk, who's Assistant State Veterinarian. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.